So the motivation for my talk today is basically exploring the space of image patches. An image patch is the most basic building block of many kinds of visual models that we build, for example, for recognition. So if we begin by sampling our images to extract a lot of, let's say, fixed size small image patches, such as 16 by 16 image patches, we want to ask ourselves, you know, what does this space look like? And we want to understand the structure of the space. And there are several kinds of tasks we're interested in. An unsupervised task is basically learning a certain lower dimensional underlying structure of the data. For example, if we believe our data has some continuous parameterization and comes from a lower dimensional manifold, we may want to know what is the dimensionality, how many free parameters do we need to describe the data. Or if we have a supervised task where we have certain class labels attached to image patches in that space, we want to learn the class structure. What does the posterior class distribution look like over this complicated space? So these are the two tasks I will talk about. And I will present quantization-based techniques for dealing with them. So why quantization? Basically, quantization, in particular nearest neighbor quantization, is a very simple and familiar operation. So we just represent our space by a certain number of prototypes or code vectors in that space, and then when we want to encode a new data point, we simply find the nearest code vector and assign to that point the index of the nearest code vector. So in computer vision, we've been using this kind of scheme a lot, for example, for bag of features image classification, to reduce each high-dimensional feature vector to just the discrete index of its nearest code vector, and to represent collections of patches by flat histograms. It really simplifies our life. But in fact, we can learn a lot of useful unsupervised structure by compressing the data, by looking at quantization error and so forth. And by digging around in quantization literature, you know, we can discover interesting theoretical results that we can apply to practical problems. So in the first half of my talk, I will talk about dimensionality estimation and how we can use quantization to find intrinsic dimensionality of data sets, and also how we can move from simply dimensionality estimation, where we assume that the data set is homogeneous and has the same dimensionality everywhere, to dimensionality separation of heterogeneous data sets, if we believe that different parts of the data have different complexities. Okay, so this is a picture from one of the seminal science papers on manifold learning. And basically, this kind of represents our belief about many kinds of image data. We believe that image data comes from a space with some sort of lower dimensional parametrization. So if we take the space of handwritten twos, for example, it's a 16 by 16 image patch, so the extrinsic dimension is pretty high. But in fact, there are only so many ways in which you can write a two, and you know, the degrees of freedom are not so many. So here, they're kind of, the twos are laid out in a two-dimensional plane, and you can kind of stare at this plane and see what are the different degrees of freedom. So from left to right, maybe the degree of freedom is how you can write the bottom loop of your two. So on the left, you know, the twos don't have any loops, and then they start getting bigger and bigger bottom loops. And from top to bottom, another degree of freedom is how you can write the top of your two. So apparently, you know, most people that I know of don't put any loop at the top of the two, but apparently there are some that write fairly elaborate loops. So these are what some of the degrees of freedom would look like. And we would actually want to learn this manifold structure. But before we can do any kind of nonlinear dimensionality reduction or manifold learning, we have to answer the most basic question of how many degrees of freedom are there. This number, this lower dimension d, is basically needed as the input to many dimensionality reduction algorithms. Okay, so let me just summarize the most basic ideas in intrinsic dimensionality estimation. So there exist many algorithms out there, and most of them in one way or another make idea of the so-called regularity assumption. So if you're dealing with a distribution on a lower dimensional, on a d-dimensional manifold, the probability of a small ball of radius epsilon on that manifold is proportional to the volume of that ball. So it's proportional to epsilon to the d. And in practice, we don't actually deal with distributions on manifolds. We deal with sets of points sampled somehow from that manifold. So we can express this by saying, you know, if we count the number of points within an epsilon ball of some target feature point, as epsilon grows, the number of points will grow as epsilon to the d. So from this, many estimation schemes have been derived, which basically reduce to the same thing. We pretty much take the log of both sides, and we plot the log of the number of points as a function of log of epsilon, and the slope of this plot then gives us the intrinsic dimension. So we get the intrinsic dimension by regression. And so one disadvantage of this scheme is that it's basically local. We have to create a little ball around each of the data points, and we have to compute this curve for each of the data points. And then we somehow have to, if we want the overall dimensionality of the data set, we somehow have to average them or do something or other. And of course, this involves an awful lot of nearest neighbor computations that we don't want to do in high dimensions. And just in practical terms, many authors have noticed that their estimates have a negative bias. So they produce numbers that are lower than they should be. Okay, so we can go to quantization theory. And it turns out that they also make use of the regularity assumption in quantization theory, which leads to a so-called high rate approximation. So it means that if we want to quantize a regular distribution on a manifold with a very large number of cold vectors, this is what high rate refers to, the root mean squared error of the quantizer basically scales as k to the minus 1 over d, where k is the number of cold vectors. So this leads to a theoretical definition of quantization dimension, and this is what it looks like. It's the limit as k, the number of cold vectors, goes to infinity of log of the number of cold vectors over minus log of the quantizer error. So it can actually be proven that for regular distributions, this limit exists, and the quantization dimension is the same as the intrinsic dimension of the manifold. So this has been known, as you can see from the date, for several decades in the vector quantization literature, but they haven't really made a lot of practical use of this theory. So mostly in this literature, they have assumed that they already know everything there is to know about the distribution on the manifold, that this d is known and so forth, and you just want to study theoretically the asymptotic behavior of quantizer error for some theoretically known distribution. But we're going to take the opposite approach. We have just a set of samples, so we're going to actually build a real quantizer, and we're going to observe how the empirical quantizer error changes the function of k and try to estimate d by regression. So it gives us really, in practice, an algorithm that looks very simple. We start with our data set. We just quantize it with a range of codebook sizes, which means we run k-means, starting with a relatively small k and gradually increasing k as far as it can go. And we simply track the root squared error of the k-means and plot then the log of k versus minus the log of the error and find the slope of the linear part of the curve. So when the curve is linear, that tells us that the high rate approximation holds, and we can get the dimension. So of course there's a very big gap between the theory of higher rate vector quantization and what we're trying to do in practice. So in theory, we're not quantizing a finite set of points, we're quantizing a distribution. In practice, of course, you know, we are only given a single data set of a fixed size, so the best we can do is approximate the distribution and the manifold by the empirical distribution of the data. In theory, once again, we're looking for the error of the optimal k-point quantizer for the distribution. In practice, we can't even find the optimal quantizer for a finite number of points. We can't, you know, k-means only gives us a local minimum, so we can't even find the optimal quantizer for the finite data set. And moreover, even if we did, then if we just measure the quantizer error on the training set, we would get a biased estimate of the quantizer error on the manifold, because the quantizer error on a finite training set is actually negatively biased. You can think of it this way. If you set k equal to the number of your data points, then every data point becomes its own center, and your quantizer error goes to zero. But then, of course, if you were to take another independent sample from the same distribution, you know, your quantizer error would not be zero with the same set of centers. So basically, as k gets larger and larger, your quantizer overfits to the data set that it was trained on, so the error is negatively biased, which means that to get a better estimate, we actually need to track the error on a held out independent test sequence. And finally, in theory, the dimension estimate is obtained in the limit as k goes to infinity. In practice, of course, k cannot go to infinity. At most, it can go to the size of the training set. And as it gets close to the size of the training set, actually things begin to break down pretty badly because the higher rate approximation no longer holds. And I will show why this is in practice. So here's a very well-known example of the Swiss roll that everybody uses for these tasks. So here on the left are the two plots of the training error of the quantizer and the test error as a function of code book size. So these dots are the actual data points that we've collected by running by learning the quantizer. But then, to see if the high rate approximation is valid, we've actually fitted parametric curves of form a plus b times k to the minus 1/2, because the intrinsic dimension is 2, you know, to see whether the fit would actually be good for what we observe. And you can see that, you know, the solid curve for the test error and the dashed curve for the training error, they're actually a pretty good fit. And here in the middle, we also see the same plot, only when we take the logarithm of k and minus log of the quantizer error. So once again, the fits are reasonably good, except, you know, in the range of high k, where especially for the training error, things begin to break down. So we have to avoid this regime. And also you can see that for the training error, the constant is negative. So this reflects the negative bias that they talked about, and the fact that when k becomes equal to the number of training points, the error will go to zero. Whereas for the test error, this constant is positive, so there's less bias. And also you can see that the test error curve is more linear than the training error curve, which means that the higher rate approximation holds better. So finally, over here, we see the actual plot of the slope of these two curves as a function of log k. So once again, in the range of high k, you can see that things begin to break. Basically, once the quantizer begins to overfit to the training set, the training dimension estimate goes to zero, because in the end, we're just learning the isolated points. We're no longer learning the structure of the manifold. And as that happens, basically the test estimate also goes off somewhere, and you no longer have a valid picture. So what we're looking for is a kind of sweet spot where both estimates are close together and both curves are more or less linear. So here's another interesting example of a toroidal spiral. So actually, this is a data set that kind of has different dimensionalities at different scales. As you look on kind of a coarse scale, it looks like a torus, so it's two-dimensional. But as you zoom in more and more, you begin to see the individual coils, so it becomes one-dimensional. And in this case, you can see that it's actually possible for these curves to have two distinct linear regions. So the first linear region corresponds to the two-dimensional torus, and the second linear region corresponds to the one-dimensional coils. And you can see that in the slope estimates where we kind of have two sweet spots. And you can also think of these curves as telling you that as you cluster the data, you know, with this many clusters, or you know, this is the log of the number of clusters, locally, this is approximately what is the dimensionality of the clusters. So if you cluster this data set with 2 to the 6 clusters or so, then it looks like the clusters are two-dimensional. But as you use 2 to the 9 clusters, then they become one-dimensional. So this is kind of what these curves are telling you.
Excuse me. So mm-hmm. this dimension estimate is, in this case, just simply the ratio of minus over log k divided by log of each. Okay.
Well, it's basically, to be more stable, it's the slope of these curves.
Also, but you compute this curve first, and then you compute the estimate the slope of the curve. Mm-hmm. Of
yeah,
the
yeah.
Why does the dimension estimate result in the clusters?
So what you have to look at is once the training estimate starts going to zero, your estimates are not valid anymore. Because you know you already, when you have so many clusters, the number of points in each cluster is too small, and the high rate approximation breaks down. Because the curve, in theory, the error is supposed to decrease very slowly, as k to the minus 1 over d. But as you get fewer and fewer points, you know it's not possible to sustain this really slow decrease. So you basically get this precipitous drop, at which point you can't really trust the estimates anymore. So by you know looking at both curves, we can see basically what is the range of validity. Okay, so here are some examples on real data, in particular the MNIST digit dataset that Jan was just discussing. So here you can see the dimension estimates visualized basically. The dimension estimate for each digit is just the height, and the blue is the training estimate, and the red is the test estimate. So we always have the test estimate slightly higher than the training estimate. And the training curve is negatively biased, and you can see that the training estimate is also negatively biased. Of course, we can't say very much about the biases that are present in the test estimate, but looking at both of them kind of gives us a better idea of the range that we might be in. So you can see that ones, for instance, have the lowest dimension estimate, which makes sense because one is the simplest digit, and eights have the highest dimension estimate, and other relatively complicated digits like threes and twos also have high estimates. So this kind of makes sense, and we also compared to the regression estimate, which I discussed in the very beginning, where you just look at the nearest neighbors of each point. And you can see that the regression estimate is even more negatively biased than the training estimate for the most part. So it seems that using an independent test set is really important in terms of avoiding negative bias. Yes?
So what would happen if you took just a Gaussian normal in 11 dimensions with only 7,000 points? Would you really, I mean, if you are uniform, you know, you just drew a uniform with 7,000 points in 11 dimensions, really find the limit dimensions?
So I don't know. I mean,
because it's so few points, mm-hmm. right? And 11, I mean, 11 dimensions is already pretty big for 7,000.
Well, I think 11 dimensions is, you know, a bit too small for this kind of extrinsic dimension, which is 16 by 16. I will show an example of other data which has a lower extrinsic dimensionality, but a higher intrinsic dimensionality estimate. So for just regular image patches, we get an intrinsic dimension estimate of about 45 or 35 or so. So 11 is pretty low. I don't know, it's actually, I guess it's a good experiment to try what you suggest, but I think you would get a lot higher than 11. You probably wouldn't get the full dimensionality every time, but. So now let me move on to dimensionality separation, is this idea that I mentioned in the beginning of my talk. And basically, I don't really believe in the myth of, you know, manifold learning, that high dimensional data is somehow homogeneous, that if you sample a lot of image patches, they will lie on a nice surface like this, where, you know, any part of the space you consider has the same number of degrees of freedom. I don't really think that's what the space of all image patches looks like. It's more likely that it's going to look like something like this. So, you know, it's going to be some kind of horrible barrel of snakes, and different parts of the space will give you different complexities. So it really depends where you look. And this is kind of what we want to do. We don't want to pretend that the whole space is nicely described by a single number d. We want to partition the space and figure out the different dimensionalities that are associated with different parts of the space. And it seems like this quantization-based method somehow should be well-suited for this task, because we're already performing quantization at multiple levels. So if we're only a little bit smarter about how we do this multi-resolution quantization, maybe we can also get a nice partitioning of the data space out of it. So let me just explain in a little more detail what we do exactly when we find these curves of quantizer error for different values of k. So what we do is really very simple. At each level, we basically initialize the estimate for the next higher value of k by just splitting some number of clusters. And then we re-estimate the centers of all the clusters simultaneously, because for the theory to work, it's really important for the quantizer to be as optimal as possible. So this is what we do. We just split a few clusters at each level, but then we re-optimize. And the re-optimization is really necessary for the theory to work, but it's a huge pain, because of course, as we get more and more clusters, this re-optimization takes up more and more memory, it gets slower and slower, and another annoying thing about it is it destroys any kind of hierarchical structure or any kind of connection between the cluster you have at one level versus the next higher level. So why don't we just forget about this re-estimation, throw the theory out the window more or less, and just do good old-fashioned tree-structured vector quantization, where at each level we split the clusters, but we no longer re-optimize. So our quantizers are going to be suboptimal now, but at least we get a hierarchical partitioning of the data space out of it. So now what we have is we have this tree, and at each node in this tree, or this tree-structured codebook, each node represents a subset of the data, and basically we can recursively compute a dimension estimate for the subset of the data rooted at each node. And we can track both the training error and the test error, as I've shown earlier, to show to tell us when we have to stop doing this. When we've basically gone too deep in the tree and there are too few points, so we can no longer trust the estimates. And there are some practical issues we have to worry about. One of them is choosing the branching factor of the tree. So the higher the branching factor, the closer to optimal our quantizer is going to be, which is good for the theory. But unfortunately, a larger branching factor gives us a fewer rate samples. So basically, the increment of k in the curve is going to be branching factor minus 1. And the fewer of these samples we can get, you know, the less reliable our estimates are going to be. We can use only very few points to find the slope and so on, so the slope is not going to be reliable. So these are very preliminary experiments that I have done. And in these experiments, basically it looks like, so these are curves, training and test error curves for blue is the actual k-means, non-hierarchical k-means, and then green is branching factor of 2. So you can see for branching factor of 2, we get some pretty ugly looking artifacts. But once we get to 3 and higher, you know, the curves for 3 and 4 look pretty much the same. They don't have the artifacts. So we're going to pick 3 because it seems that it's not as prone to artifacts, and it's, you know, the lowest, the next lowest branching factor to 2. So this is what we have once we apply restructured vector quantization instead of non-hierarchical k-means to get dimension estimates for the digits. So these are the old estimates I showed earlier. And now when we use the suboptimal quantizer, we get, as you can see, estimates that are much higher. So, you know, making the quantizer more suboptimal inflates the estimates. So like for 8, the test estimate goes from about 25 to about 35, which is a bit high. So it means we can't really trust these exact numbers, but at least it seems that we can still trust the relative numbers. So the trends here are exactly the same as the trends here. So we can use these inaccurate estimates just as well as we could have used these estimates to get an idea of the relative complexities of the different digits.
When you run this tree on the torus example, do you get quite good estimates in that case?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, you get what you would expect. You get 2. You know, if you know the dimension of the torus is 2, you get 2. You know, anything you do in like 2 to 5 dimensions pretty much works out, especially if you know the dimension of your surface. It gets much harder in examples such as these because you don't actually know what the true answer is. That's kind of the pain of working with real data. You don't really know what answer to expect. I mean, you can, you know, kind of see whether it makes sense. So it makes sense that one would have the lowest estimate. But apart from that, unfortunately, you know, we can't say very much about how accurate this is and so on and so forth. And, you know, of course, I shouldn't even have to say this. Tree-structured vector quantization is much faster and much more memory efficient than the exhaustive clustering. And even if we would have preferred to use the exhaustive k-means because it's more accurate, pretty soon we couldn't do it because we would just run out of memory and computation time. And as I will explain in a little bit, I really want to apply these things to millions of data points. So it means that even if we don't like the fact that hierarchical clustering gives us less accurate estimates, at some point we don't have a choice because we can't apply the exhaustive k-means to such large data sets. So let me show some preliminary experiments on the digits data. So for the digits data, the extrinsic dimensionality actually is 784. Oh, because they're actually 28 by 28. That's not a very intuitive size, so I didn't remember what it was. And then I've just sampled a data set of 750,000 grayscale image patches, for which they're 16 by 16 patches, so the extrinsic dimensionality is 256. So this is the codebook tree for the digits, where here we start with all the digits put together, so we no longer separate them by hand based on their identity. And you can see that for the whole data set, we get a training estimate of about 15 and the test estimate of about 24. And then as we go down the tree, you can also see here, you know, how the dimension estimates change as we go down the tree. We get things like this. For instance, once the ones separate out from all the rest of the digits, the dimensionality drops. So this cluster of ones really has a much lower dimensionality than everything else. The ones are over here. And then here, for example, we have some clusters that mainly have eights and threes, and they have higher dimensionalities because they're more complex. So it kind of makes some sense. I mean, you know, this tree is not really the best way of visualizing what happens, but for now, it's kind of the best thing I can think of. And for patches, it gets even messier. We have many more patches than we have digits. But what's interesting is what I mentioned is that the extrinsic dimensionality of patches is lower than digits because they're smaller, but the intrinsic dimension estimate is actually higher. We get 32 here instead of 16 or so, which once again makes sense because just generic image patches are more complex than digits. But apart from this, there's not very much else we can say because the tree just becomes too much of a mess. So I tried another way of visualizing what you get. So these are basically the leaves in the codebook tree, arranged in a kind of histogram according to their intrinsic dimension estimates. So on the low end of the histogram, we get leaves that look like this. So you can see that these patches basically are mostly uniform or are kind of bars or straight edges. So it makes sense that these would be the lowest dimensional subsets. And on the high end, we get things that look like this. Gradients, blobs, curved edges, and so forth. So there's some kind of pattern here. And here's another way to visualize what makes a given subtree lower dimensional versus higher dimensional. So these are a couple of low dimensional subtrees. So you can see intuitively they have fewer degrees of freedom. So over here we have this patch that's mostly white on top and black on the bottom. And as we go down the tree, we can see that the code words at the lower levels of the tree pretty much look the same as the ones in the higher level of the tree. So maybe this line wiggles up or down a little, or this gradient changes, but there really isn't that much freedom in how these patches change. So that's what makes a lower dimensional subtree. And here is a higher dimensional subtree. So you can see that the leaves of the subtree actually look nothing like this higher level code word. So there is actually a lot of degrees of freedom in the subtree. So intuitively, that's what makes some parts of the space higher dimensional. So in the future, what I really want to do is apply these techniques on much more interesting data sets. So one of these interesting data sets is the tiny images data set that Rob Fergus talked about a couple of days ago. So it should be great. It has, I think, 80 million points. And you know, these images, their color, and they're actually little scenes. They're not just little patches where you would have a very simple pattern like an edge or something. You have a lot more content, so presumably you would learn a lot more from examining this kind of data. And another data that I'm interested in is human motion capture. Actually, I got this whole idea of dimensionality separation as I was talking to a graphics researcher who works with human motion, and he tried to use nonlinear dimensionality reduction techniques, and he was complaining that they don't really make any sense for motion because they require you to give a global dimension estimate or a global number of parameters with which to parameterize all motions, and motions vary a lot in their complexity. Because walking, for example, would be relatively simple and has relatively few degrees of freedom, whereas maybe dancing or something else has many more degrees of freedom. So this is exactly what you want to do with motion data. You want to separate it out and simultaneously learn how many parameters you need, let's say, to effectively compress each kind of motion. So to summarize our approach to dimensionality estimation, it's kind of interesting. It makes use of higher rate vector quantization theory, which relates basically a topological property of a manifold, its intrinsic dimension, to an operational property, which is the behavior of quantizer error for that manifold. It's really kind of interesting and not very intuitive at first. And just in practice, applying this dimensionality estimation method is nicer than getting regression estimates because you don't have to do as many nearest neighbor computations, and it kind of has a good trade-off between local structure and global structure. And, you know, so in principle, we can use hierarchical quantization methods to perform partitioning of the data set, although there remain many unsolved issues as to exactly how you can do this. And in particular, how you can visualize this, you know, I've tried to draw some trees, but these trees get out of hand very quickly. So how can you visualize the hierarchical structure of a data set of 80 million pictures? And also, how can you validate the answers that you get, because we just don't know the true answer? So let me now move on and talk briefly about a different kind of problem. Basically a problem of codebook learning for a supervised task. So what we want to do in a lot of vision problems in recognition, we start with our continuous image fetches, and we want to predict their class labels. They come with some discrete class labels. So we want to do this with the help of a codebook. So we build a nearest neighbor codebook, and we want this codebook to be such that we can predict the class label of a patch from the discrete code word index, as well as we could have predicted it from the original feature vector. So how can we do this? This basically can be formulated in information theoretic terms. So to be informative, this code word index K should approximate a sufficient statistic of the feature vector X for the class label Y. So ideally, if K is in fact a sufficient statistic, you don't need X at all to do this prediction. But in practice, of course, it's not possible. This quantization is compression, so some information is bound to be lost. So what we want to do in practice is just to minimize the loss of information about the class label that occurs when we do the quantization. So actually, we draw on a lot of previous work on information theoretic clustering. And there is a formulation for information loss minimization when you just talk about class distributions, when you disregard the continuous vector space structure of the data and just look at the problem of quantizing the class distributions associated with the data points. So basically what happens is when we represent a given feature vector X sub I by some kind of discrete codebook index K, we replace the actual class distribution associated with that feature vector by the by a different class distribution associated with the code vector. So in the next few slides, P sub I will stand for the class distribution of the ith feature point, and pi sub k will stand for the prototype class distribution of the kth code vector. So basically, it turns out that to minimize information loss, you have to find a set of these prototype code distributions that minimize the KL divergences between the distributions of the feature points and the distributions they get encoded to. So you can think of it as being exactly analogous to the error function for k-means clustering, except instead of squared Euclidean distance, you have KL divergences. And you're not comparing vectors, but you're comparing their class distributions. And you can optimize this in exactly the same way that you can optimize, that you can do k-means. You just do k-means with KL divergence in the space or the probability simplex of class distributions. So you start with some set of pi sub k's. You simply assign each p sub I to the nearest pi sub k as measured by KL divergence. And then you obtain a new set of pi sub k's by averaging the p sub i's that fall in each cell. It has exactly the same properties as k-means. But it can't actually be used by us for our problem of codebook learning because there's nothing at all in here about the structure of the feature space. And another annoying thing about it is that you actually need this to know this class distribution of the feature point in order to do the encoding. Which for us is no good because we want to be able to apply the encoding to test points for which the class distribution is not yet known. If it was known, then our problem would already be solved. And that's just no good. So what we do instead is we change the optimization problem basically by saying that we have a feature space, and what we want to do is we want to put a set of prototypes in the feature space to minimize the same error. But the prototypes now exist in the feature space, and the encoding also takes place in the feature space. So when we have a new feature point, x sub I, we simply encode it to the nearest code vector in the feature space, m sub k, and then we can look up at training time, we can look up the error in the probability simplex. So we're minimizing the error in the probability simplex, but what we're looking for is a set of code vectors in the feature space that minimizes this error. And the encoding also depends only on the feature space. The encoding does not know anything about this distribution, so you can apply the test time to new data points. So there's one more thing we have to do to make this a differentiable objective function, and that is to go from hard Bernoulli partitioning of the feature space to basically soft clustering. So we put some soft assignment weights on the points, so each data point gets assigned to each code vector with some weight, which inversely depends on the distance. And now the objective function becomes differentiable, and it also depends on two set of parameters, basically the set of centers m in the feature space and the set of prototype distributions pi in the probability space. So that immediately suggests alternating minimization. First, we fix. Well, all alternating minimization looks like EM, which doesn't make it EM. So. Well, I mean, it's if you actually look at the motivation and so on, it's completely different. Here, you're simply, all you want to do is reduce a given error. And you have two set of parameters. And in many problems, it just makes sense to fix one set of parameters and find new values for the other set that reduce the error function and just keep alternating. Well, it looks like EM, but you know, the theory is different behind each of them. So.
For a GNN,
well, sure, but
exactly.
This is not, you know, this is, we're not doing Gaussian mixtures
or
anything. Yeah, but I mean, in some cases they are equivalent, but generally speaking, it can have an alternating minimization algorithm for a domain where, you know, there are no probabilities and there's nothing, you know, that can relate it to EM at all.
Yeah, it just seems
like
a logical structure and problem applied.
Well, yeah, because I mean, it's a very common thing to do. You know, so I'm sure there are many smarter ways to optimize this objective function. It's just an objective function, and we can do any of the things, for example, that Andrew discussed yesterday, but this is what we do, and it has this progress guarantee that you reduce the error every time, so it works well enough for us. And here's an example of exactly how it works. So this is a simple data set where we have one class of points, the red class in the circle in the middle, and then the blue class is in a ring around it, and both sets of points are uniformly distributed, so basically if you just run standard k-means, it tells you nothing about the class structure. But then when we initialize the information loss minimization with the output of the k-means, this is what happens. The centers basically migrate to find more or less decision regions for the two classes. And you can also see that this code book works better than k-means for nearest neighbor, and it preserves more mutual information because mutual information is basically what we're explicitly maximizing here. And in another example where the classes are no longer perfectly separable and the points are not uniformly distributed, more or less the same thing happens. K-means puts boundaries actually in the dense regions belonging to the red class, whereas when you do the information loss minimization, you see something like this. The decision regions of the two classes are found much better. And we get the same picture essentially when we move to real data, and the main point of this slide is just to show that it works in exactly the same way in more than two dimensions and for more than two classes. So here, let's say that USPS data set has actually 256 dimensional feature vectors. So it works just fine. And then we applied it to bag of features image classification. This is a data set of 15 scene categories, and we sample 16 by 16 patches on a regular grid and represent each patch with 128 dimensional feature vector. So these are the feature vectors that we're actually using here to learn the codebook. So as you can see, the classification results with this codebook found by information loss minimization are higher than the classification rates for just plain k-means. And here's a comparison of the codebooks for just 32 centers. So for k-means, the centers look kind of uniform and washed out. But for the other codebook, they look much more interesting. We have textures, we have patterns with higher contrast, so somehow intuitively, this better corresponds to our idea of, you know, what a more informative codebook should be like. And finally, let me just show you one more application of the exact same framework, but to a problem that at first looks completely different. So now, instead of doing finding partitions in a high-dimensional feature space, we want to just find a partition in the two-dimensional image space. So we want to find a Voronoi partition of an image with respect to C centers, and each center will have its own characteristic appearance distribution, such that basically the appearance, the local appearance of each pixel will be as similar as possible to the average appearance of the region that it was assigned to. So this is the same objective function, but now it's applied to image segmentation instead of codebook learning. And it turns out actually that this kind of objective function makes a lot of sense for image segmentation. It has been proposed before in the context of basically variational segmentation, where you want to break up an image into two regions by a curve. And the specifics of the optimization here are completely different, but the function looks very similar. You want to basically minimize the KL divergences between the appearance of the pixel in each region and the overall appearance of that region. So here's one example of how this actually works. When we start with a set of centers that are uniformly distributed in the image, and this is how they evolve for a few iterations. So this is not meant to be state-of-the-art image segmentation, but it gives kind of a very intuitive picture of what our algorithm does. And you can see that it tries to basically position the centers in such a way as to make the regions as uniform as possible. And here's another example. So it doesn't work perfectly. It has some artifacts, for example, like near the top of the dog's head. And this is, of course, because the algorithm is prone to local minima, and because also this kind of uniform Voronoi partitioning is just not a very efficient way to segment an image. But these kinds of things can be fixed, for example, by just adaptively splitting cells that have a high error in them or having like a hierarchical segmentation algorithm. So in any case, it's very intuitive and it makes a lot of sense what it does. So just to summarize this part of, or you know, one of the messages of my talk is, in general, I found in my work quantization to be a very important and basic operation in forming many kinds of visual representations, whether it be supervised or unsupervised. And for many tasks, it just makes life so much easier when you can boil down, you know, a high dimensional feature vector into just a discrete index. So in this case, this codebook learning algorithm is discriminative, so it's meant to preserve all the information that's necessary for your target prediction task, yet it doesn't have anything in it that's particular to a given classifier. There's no classifier loss functions or anything like that in the optimization. And so far, we've applied it to two different problems. for construction of visual code books and image segmentations. And in the future, I want to apply it to more things. For example, I'm interested in simultaneous quantization of multiple attributes. When, for example, you want to quantize texture attributes such as SIF descriptors at the same time as color and position. So how can we jointly quantize all of these things? So that concludes my talk, basically. And I don't think I need to repeat this. So, do you have any questions?